The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
Because my individual actions don't make a meaningful difference, it looks like we may not have a duty not to contribute to massive structural problems like climate change. So it's not the case that we must reduce our carbon footprint at every opportunity. But it is good to do so, and so we have a reason to take action. We can make sense of the moral pull without implying a moral must.
Hi, this is the Next Big Idea Daily. I'm your host, Michael Kovnet, and it's Wednesday. Do you drive a car? Do you eat meat? Do you buy clothes? You probably do some of these things. They're perfectly normal things to do in the modern world, of course. But they're also moral decisions, because these everyday activities have implications for the climate, animal welfare, human labor conditions, and more. I'm not judging or trying to bum you out. The fact is, even if you want to make the best, most moral choices possible, how to calibrate your individual needs and desires with the greater good is a complicated calculation. So complicated, in fact, you may be tempted to just give up and to do whatever the hell you want. But that would be a mistake, according to Travis Reeder, author of the new book, Catastrophe Ethics: How to Choose Well in a World of Tough Choices. Travis teaches at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, where he directs the Master of Bioethics degree program. And he's got some ideas about how to navigate the tricky terrain of being a good person in a complex world.
Modern life is morally puzzling. The modern world is full of ethical puzzles that have the following form. We, as individuals, feel some moral responsibility to change the way we act in response to some terrible threat. But no action on our part can play a meaningful role in addressing that threat. The paradigm case here is climate change. Nearly 20 years ago, the philosopher Walter Sinnott Armstrong asked whether, given the realities of climate change, each of us is obligated not to take joyrides in an inefficient vehicle, like, say, a Hummer. He called this the example of joy guzzling. Most of us with environmentalist tendencies feel like the answer must be yes. You shouldn't generate gratuitous emissions, given that they contribute to a catastrophic threat. But of course, even relatively large contributions for an individual, like, say, a transatlantic flight, is insignificant compared to the scale of the problem. Sinnott Armstrong proposed that a joy guzzle may emit 14 kilograms of CO2. A transatlantic flight may emit a metric ton of CO2. But dangerous climate change occurs when trillions of tons of CO2 accumulate in the atmosphere. Thus, many of us feel that we should reduce our carbon footprints, but no individual action will make a meaningful difference to the outcome. And if it won't make a difference, what could ground an obligation to refrain? After all, emitting isn't wrong in itself. It's only a problem because the combined effect of 8 billion other people doing it cooks the planet. Although this description might make it sound like climate change is a unique problem, it is not. The scale and complexity of the global population and the systems that connect us raise what I call the puzzle of individual morality in the context of many massive collective threats, including the harms from animal agriculture, consumerism, infectious disease, and more. The puzzle, as I put it, is everywhere. This puzzle of individual ethics in a time of collective threats arises because the moral tools that we unthinkingly rely on for reasoning our way through life are not fit for this kind of problem. Imagine you've never seen a car before, never even heard of one before, and so you have absolutely no experience with how to drive one. Now imagine that you are shown a car, and so you open the door and sit in the driver's seat. Looking around at the controls, you start to develop an intuition about how to drive. Should you trust that intuition? Should you start messing around and try to pull out into traffic? The empirical moral psychologist Joshua Green says the answer is clearly no, and for a very illuminating reason. There's no plausible story to explain how your driving intuition could have been calibrated. And so if you really did know how to drive, it would be a cognitive miracle. Since we shouldn't believe in cognitive miracles, you should be very skeptical that you could actually safely pull out into traffic. I think we should say something similar about any intuitions that we have about the puzzle. Green says that cases in which there is no plausible calibration story for our intuitions are unfamiliar. And so when we encounter unfamiliar cases, that's when we should assume the no cognitive miracles principle. Climate change and related puzzles are unfamiliar in the history of humanity. For almost the entire history of our species, humans have lived in small groups where the effects of one's actions could be traced and noticed. Our moral judgments were developed and intuitions have been calibrated through cultural and educational transmission in that environment. The result of this, I argue, is that our conceptual tools for moral reasoning are just not well suited for solving problems like the puzzle. Paradigmatically, we evaluate the morality of actions by investigating notions like harm and benefit, respect, the dignity and autonomy of other people, and the like. But none of these concepts are well suited to the novel challenges of a population of 8 billion people, tightly connected through technology and economics, such that our minuscule individual actions slowly add up to disaster. We need new moral tools for a new world. One way to dissolve the puzzle of individual action in a time of collective disaster is to look for a way to explain how some actions are good and bad, recommended or not, without requiring that actions in such a case are required or prohibited. I do this by focusing on the concept of a reason. Some time ago, my daughter and I were driving home, and right as we turned into our neighborhood, we saw a large turtle very slowly making its way across a busy road. My daughter cried out that I needed to save the turtle, as there seemed no way that it would survive its ambitious mission on its own. Now, I don't think we have duties to rescue wild animals. The world is chock full of animals in mortal danger, and we would find ourselves in a strange place if we thought that we were morally required to save them all. After all, do we save the gazelle from the lion or the lion from starvation? However, what my daughter seemed right to point out was that I had a reason to rescue the turtle. If left to its own devices, it would likely get smashed, suffer, and die. Suffering and death are bad, and so they count in favor of my helping the critter to avoid it. What this sort of story is supposed to make clear is that there can be something good or bad about actions, they can be recommended or not, without it being the case that one has a relevant duty. The concept of a reason explains how this is the case, as a reason is just a consideration that counts in favor or against some action. In the case of the turtle, the fact that it would suffer and die if I did nothing counted in favor of rescue, and so I judged that there was good reason to save the turtle. This is not, to blow out of proportion, a story about a turtle, but rather to point out that there are, as my friend and colleague put it to me, degrees of shouldiness in our moral lives. Sometimes we should do something, but it's not a big deal if we don't. It's a weak should. It's just recommended, and the stakes aren't too high. But sometimes we really must do something. It's a strong should. At the most stringent end of the spectrum is the concept of an obligation or duty, while at the other end is the notion of a reason. Because my individual actions don't make a meaningful difference, it looks like we may not have a duty not to contribute to massive structural problems like climate change. So it's not the case that we must reduce our carbon footprint at every opportunity. But it is good to do so, and so we have a reason to take action. We can make sense of the moral pull without implying a moral must. We have lots of reasons. Once we recognize that we have reasons to act every time there is value in not contributing to some problem, we will realize that we have lots of reasons. Every time an action of ours contributes in a tiny way to some massive collective harm, we have a reason not to do it. But a lot of our actions implicate us in big structural problems. Should you walk instead of drive? Pass on animal-sourced foods for a given meal? try to use less energy at home, minimize waste. There are good things about each, which means there are reasons to do them. Additionally, all of those reasons are negative. They are reasons not to do something or to withdraw, to varying degrees, from harmful systems. But there's also value to being part of good collective outcomes, which generate positive reasons or reasons to do something. Consider, should you volunteer your time for the environmental movement or donate money to a climate organization? Doing either would make you a participant in some good collective effort. You would be part of a solution, and so you have positive reason to do those things. Consider the case of deciding whether to buy an electric car. Because the world needs to phase out internal combustion engines, there is a strong reason not to participate in that old tech, and to instead opt in to cleaner energy. However, it's also true that the batteries that power electric cars require large amounts of cobalt, much of which is mined in the Democratic Republic of Congo, under conditions that have been called modern-day slavery. So buying an electric car makes one a participant in green technology. That's a reason for it, but also a participant in horrifying labor practices. Definitely a reason against. The reality that we have moral reasons to take care in how we contribute to massive structural problems and solutions makes clear that our current ethical situation is terribly complex. The complex, modern moral world demands some sort of decision procedure for helping us to organize the reasons we have. We need to triage various moral emergencies and the ways in which we respond to them. To help us do that, consider the case of my dear friends Liz and Nate Brownlee, who run Nightfall Farm, a small regenerative farm in southern Indiana. I stayed with them on their farm because I am so impressed with the way in which their entire lives are bound up in their moral mission to heal the land and provide good food to their community. When I asked them if they felt a moral requirement to do their work, they quickly dismissed the idea, noting that it suits their drive and their passion, and that they would discourage anyone who didn't feel similarly from following them. Their life is just too hard to sustain if it's not the thing that you feel compelled to do. One central lesson I took from my time with the Brownlees is that there is so much hard moral work to be done that we should prioritize projects and responses in terms of our personal values, desires, drives, talents, and privilege. As a writer, speaker, and teacher, I have a certain skill set and opportunity for contributing to various efforts that my farmer friends don't, just as their skill and occupation allow them to do all sorts of good that I can't. This sort of division of moral labor seems not only appropriate, but necessary. We need regenerative farmers, and we need writers. We also need people to fund various moral efforts, and people to work in them. Sometimes the people with money don't have the time, and vice versa. We contribute in different ways according to our abilities and interests. But our work is never done. There's always more you can do, and it would be better if you did. Part of the triaging of our moral efforts, then, is constantly managing the balance between the moral pull of near-infinite reasons and the burnout trying to do everything possible. Aligning our efforts with our values, interests, gifts, and drives can help us to walk this ethical tightrope.
All right, everyone. I hope those ideas from Travis help you think through your own moral choices. You can pick up a copy of his book for some more detailed advice. That title, again, is Catastrophe Ethics: How to Choose Well in a World of Tough Choices. I'm going to be back tomorrow with some eye-opening ideas from another recent book, Nuclear War, A Scenario, by Annie Jacobson. I'm Michael Kovnat, and oh, I've got a newsletter. It's a weekly roundup of the most interesting and useful ideas from the best new nonfiction. Sign up for free using the link in the episode notes or look for the next big idea on LinkedIn. See you tomorrow.